eat these now. Seconds. Good morning. Happy Wednesday. We are on Problem Corner. We are live in the studio with our Congressman Nick Begich, 3, NB3, we affectionately call him, our sole congressman for Alaska. You also worked for Congressman Young before he departed the position and was replaced with Mary Peltola, and then you defeated her in her second run, and you represent our entire state.
The whole state, and it's an honor to do the job. I'm just here for the week. We've got what they call a district work period, so the break between vote series. Members go back to their districts, and our district, it's almost funny to say that, but because we always know that we just have one member of Congress in the United States House. But
with the largest.
With the largest, yes. And I love to remind people of that in D.C. because
why would you need more money to travel your district?
Oh, yeah, and they don't. They don't. They don't give you a significant greater allocation than other
members. It's not like
members.
Delaware, like you can drive it.
No, it's definitely not. And I have to remind people of that. You know, they talk about, well, I'm from a rural district out here in Congress. And I say, well, can you drive there? Right? And the answer is always yes. And look, I mean, just this week, it's Juneau to Anchorage to Squinton out in the West Susitna, and then back to Anchorage, and then out to Aniak, and then Bethel, and then back to Anchorage last night, and then here in Fairbanks, North Pole, Fort Greeley, and then back to D.C., and that's 1 week.
And I've seen your schedule, and your illustrious local staffer, Leslie Hagudukadovich, who we love here in town, has really packed you in tight, and you still sought us out and wanted to come on Problem
Corner. I love coming on the radio. I really love the long-form format. Because unlike print, where you might get one or two sentences, here you can talk about an issue in more detail, which I love, and an opportunity to hear from other folks and learn some things. Because as anyone out there can appreciate, you can't know everything. And,
you can't.
And I don't, and I won't ever claim to. I learn most of what I know from people who are closer to the issues and come to me with their challenges and then a set of solutions we can work on together.
And so there are a number of challenges and solutions related to the main interior Alaska priorities: energy, security, mining, supporting the university, protecting military readiness. Mm. What are you working on right now?
Oh, gosh. Well, let's start with an easy one. There's a lot there. But certainly when you talk about – let's talk about energy for a minute, because I think that feeds into so many of the other topics that you were touching on. And then we can drill down into the other topics.
And we could be
topics.
On the precipice of our gas line.
We could be. And I have had conversations with leadership at Glenfarne. Certainly we're in close communication with the governor's office, who's helping to spearhead that project from a governmental perspective. In D.C., there's a strong alignment among the delegation that we need to lower energy costs in Alaska. And we need a long-term solution to the declining production in the Cook Inlet, which those on the rail belt have been reliant upon, even indirectly, for quite some time. So I'm encouraged to see the progress. What they call FID, or the final investment decision, should come in Q1 of next year or early Q2. I'm expecting it could be a little quicker than that, but that's what I'm hearing, is that it's right around the corner. You've always needed three things for the gas line. You need producers willing to sell their gas. You need customers willing to buy the gas. And somebody's got to pay for the doggone gas line. And so it turns out the people with the money aren't interested in financing it unless they know that there's customers and producers willing to sell.
And you're in a unique position. We've had representatives in Congress who've had a background in the natural resources side of things, but yours is in economics and finance. And you we've been having the discussions for so long that people say, what will be different? You do have a different perspective in order to talk to those investors.
And it is important. And I was there with members of the House Natural Resources Committee in Japan, in Korea, in Taiwan. This year, we took a delegation and we met with folks in industry. We met with folks in government. The folks we met with in government were at the highest levels. I personally met with both the vice president and the president of Taiwan. I met with very senior ministry officials, Ministry of Finance, Ministry of Resources and Energy in Japan. I met with the president of Korea. So we were meeting with the decision makers and their industry partners. And in every conversation that we had, before I even had an opportunity to bring up Alaska Natural Gas, they were bringing it up.
We're finally on the world stage, and so much of our energy discussions, the average public sometimes will think simply from the permitting and extraction and taxability of a corporation, but we've been having focused discussions here in Fairbanks and around the state, but specifically here in Fairbanks and in the northern portion of our state, that energy efficiency and energy affordability relates to everything. It relates to our domestic security. It relates to, we talk about economic development. You cannot have the discussion without lowering the cost
that
of energy.
That is 100% true. And, you know, when you talk about some of the bigger, broader themes that are happening around the country and the world, you know, we're talking about cryptocurrency and AI and all these other things. What's interesting is you're starting to see that the hardware components of those industries are starting to become more commoditized, and the data centers and the consumption activity within those industries, which are major drivers of our global growth right now, are migrating to those locations that have the most stable and low-cost energy.
And let's give a primer for that before we take our quarter break, because we have to diversify. Of course, we have the extractable energy, and we have to lower the cost of energy. But that, do you see that as markets where Alaska, especially, you know, with the reactors and the computer stuff we have, we're cold.
Right, which is a natural advantage in this context.
And we got stuff in the ground that can be extracted, right?
Well, and this is a great way for us to leverage our comparative advantages. So in Alaska, we have comparative advantage, as you point out, with colder weather. That's great when it comes to computing needs, right? You got to cool a data center. So you start with a colder environment that lowers your cost. You've got abundant energy. And we don't have a lot of customers outside of ourselves at the moment for that energy. But when we unlock it on that gas pipeline, oh my goodness. I mean, we can attract as energy tenants these AI data centers, these crypto data centers. And it's not a pie in the sky idea. These people are begging us in Congress for sources of energy. And I can't tell you, it's Republicans and Democrats that are hearing the same message from leaders. And it doesn't matter what side of the aisle those leaders are on. These industry people are coming to us, begging us, saying it doesn't matter what the energy source is. They don't care if it's nuclear, coal, hydro, gas, doesn't matter. They're agnostic to the energy source because they're so concerned that we could lose the AI race to China. And Alaska does provide a real alternative.
And if they're housing those centers here, then that energy source is nearby, and it overcomes some of what our long-term challenge has been. You know, how do we get things shipped out of here so others can use it? Well, when your data center is located here, it's right next to your energy source. So I'll let you give a quick wrap-up on this segment, and then we'll go to a break.
You got it. So, look, I do think it's important for us to have those longer-term conversations. I think we've got to find some energy tenants here in-state, not just exporting our gas. That's great, and that's going to be fantastic for our economy when that happens. But we want some jobs here in state. We want some opportunities here in state. And by lowering our energy costs, we can attract growth industries to Alaska, but we can also start developing Alaska. And we recognize that energy has been a limiting factor for us in Alaska. And the gas line has the opportunity to unlock some things that we've been pursuing for quite some time.
Congressman Nick Begich will lead in to our next segment with a wrap-up of that. And we are back on Problem Corner with our congressman, our sole congressman, Nick Begich, NB3. And we were just talking about our position with the ability to attract additional industries and gas line readiness. And at the break, we were talking about a theme we've hit on Problem Corner many times here. We had Amy from the Joint Pipeline Training Center. We've had a few of the apprenticeship leaders here. And the need for us to be ready to bolster our workforce at exactly the right time so that we can capture as many of those opportunities for Alaskans. We have an obligation constitutionally to hire Alaskans first, realizing that not everyone will be able to fill those immediate needs for positions. Some people will come from the lower 48. They will need to train some of our workers. But can you talk to us a little more about what we talked about at the break and your relationship with the Secretary of Labor, the discussions that are going on in Congress to be able to appropriate in time to bolster our apprenticeship programs so that people want to live in Fort Yukon and Taslina and take those jobs here long term and invest in their family and not simply work up here for 2 weeks and pay their property taxes somewhere else.
Right. No, I totally agree. And I think we need to make sure that as many of those jobs that can go to Alaskans go to Alaskans. And in order to do that, we have to make sure that we are preparing Alaskans for those jobs. And that's what apprenticeships and the Joint Pipeline Training Center are all about. And there are a number of programs throughout the state. I was just actually in Bethel yesterday, as I mentioned, and they were very proud of some of their training programs out there. We're going to need people from all over parts of the state. It's going to come from interior. It's going to come from southeast. It's going to come from south central. It's going to come from the villages. It's going to be all hands on deck to get this work done. And so we're going to need every training center to be oriented. This is really important. Oriented toward the jobs that we need. So it's not just, hey, we need training and we need jobs. No, we need the kind of jobs that people are going to be asking for when they're building this pipeline. What does that mean? It means electricians, welders, truck drivers. I mean, we know what these jobs are going to be. It's actually a very extensive list. I mean, you need everything from accountants all the way through. But the bulk of the number of jobs that are going to be necessary, we need to align our training to those opportunities. And we got to start right now in order for those folks to be available.
The training and the outreach. We need to educate Alaskans. When you're 19 years old and you're deciding, you know, which apprenticeship should I pick? Do I want to be an accountant? Do I want to be a small motor repair person? Part of the way we base that is on what is the pay, how long is the career, and how available is that to me. I may fit in three or four different things, but thankfully our workforce development folks are analyzing that, and so we will be looking to you for appropriations for the training as well as some of the outreach. This listenership would much rather see it spent on something like that we can capture than this long trail, which has been.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. The long trail. That's a whole – let me just make one comment, and I'll jump back to the lawn trail. But just a personal story. My dad – so my parents were pretty young when I was born. And my dad was 19, but before I was born, he was working on the pipeline. And he made really good money. And did he stay in those trades? No. He ended up doing something else later in life. So a lot of people worked on the pipeline. You know, a lot of people stayed in the trade that they were in when they worked there, and other people went off and did other things. But the money was so good. For the people who remember, the money was so good that you really wanted to be a part of that project. Mm-hmm. And I think for young people, hopefully, you know, for folks that are listening, maybe parents or grandparents who remember those times, you know, a young person can move into one career, build up some cash, pay for their college, if that's what they want to do later.
Right.
Out of pocket, you know, with the savings, if they're stewarding
those
funds.
They're not mutually
exclusive. No, you can do both. So I would just encourage folks to think laterally in those ways. But so you touched on a topic, the long trail. And the long trail, when I first heard about it many years ago, I thought, oh, that sounds like a nice idea. And then you start learning more about what these projects really are. And you discover that actually it's a project that will dissect many of the opportunities that we have in Alaska.
You think you're making a trail, you're opening areas up, but in many cases, some of those areas are being closed because of
that's
the
right
trail.
because of the right of way, let's say red tape that comes along with
and restrictions.
That's
to the
right
type of trail.
Yeah, and so you know, you suddenly it's restricting your ability to develop lands and
to
build.
So now there's a group that wants to talk to you today about what they want funded and that they don't want the Long Trail funded, as the article is in the News Miner today. There's also another article praising one of our high school small motor repair shop classes, you know, preparing young people for what they might want to do. You know, taking those classes will help you fix your, if you're not going down that path, you can at least fix your own machine. But our workforce, again, here in Fairbanks and luckily down in South Central, so many of our military fall in love with Alaska. That's what happened to my dad. That's why I'm here.
Yep.
He was Coast Guard. We had two different tours up here. And you know, some of our very accomplished surgeons come up here and say, why do we have such well-accomplished, highly rated people? Because they love our state and they love our lifestyle.
Right.
And there are pathways to the trades right now for many of our veterans. You're also working on veteran support for Fort Greeley and the Missile Defense and the new Veterans Cemetery in Salcha.
Yep.
And tell us a little bit about that.
Well, as most longtime Alaskans know, but maybe new Alaskans aren't familiar, we have the highest veteran population per capita than any other state in the country.
I had stand down a couple weeks ago.
Yeah, and I think you touched on, you know, people ask, well, why is that? Well, first of all, we have a significant military presence here, but it's more than that, because a lot of folks who fill that veteran population in the state aren't from Alaska. They come in from somewhere else. They have an opportunity to be stationed here. They love it. And whether they retire here or they leave and then come back, they fall in love with Alaska. And it's interesting that you have a similar story. I have a similar story in my family. My grandfather and grandmother on my mom's side came up before Alaska was a state. They were actually stationed here in Fairbanks in the Air Force. And, you know, later on they were in Anchorage and then stayed in Alaska. So it's a great way for people to be introduced to our state, but we want to honor our veterans, and that's part of what that Veterans Cemetery in Salcher that we've been supporting, and I know many others have been supportive of. That's what that's about. That's part of our honoring our commitment to Alaska's veterans. They're an important part of our community, and we wouldn't be here as a state without that strong military.
And our congressional delegation in the Senate and in the House has always supported that. And our communities, you know, we work through the chamber and through several of our committees where we constantly are reminding folks that our military presence is not only patriotic, but, you know, part of our community. And so many of our military spouses are working actively, filling some of the jobs, bringing some of their trades, whether it's accounting or hairdressing or teaching. We have, you know, we work very hard as a community to support our military.
I'm so appreciate that you bring that up, because it's not just the military service, active duty service military members themselves. It's also the families that they bring into our communities and the spouses that contribute, as you pointed out, in a number of different professions. We want to make it easy for people to do that too, right? I know there's sometimes there's regulatory barriers for someone to come in, and this is true around the country, but we want to make sure Alaska is welcoming to the entire family when they get here, and that spouses who are working and have a profession, that they're able to plug in to our communities and do the things that they've been trained to do and that they derive value from.
And that we're having a quality community that they can live in. They have the choice to bring their family up here or not. When we have enough housing, we have schools and choices that they want to enroll in, then, you know, we're building a community that's more welcoming. Can you believe we are halfway through our radio show?
I cannot. The time flies.
It goes fast.
Yes, it does.
So what particularly, let's close this section out with military, and then I know you wanted to talk about healthcare, but so you've got the Salcha Cemetery, you have military funding. What around the state, what meetings are you having back east that you can tell us about that are related specifically to the military before we get
Yeah, so actually state? I just had a meeting with an assistant secretary in DOD last week, and it was related to the coal plant, right, at Wainwright, and making sure that stayed open. And there has been some real concern around whether that's going to stay open, because here's what you need to understand. If you're listening today, here's what you need to understand: that coal that gets sold there, the producer of that coal, Usabelli, needs a certain amount of production to be able to keep the lights on at Usabelli, right?
Right.
And so if you lose a significant anchor customer like that, it makes it difficult for them to serve the other customers who rely on the electricity that's generated from their other coal plants. So you'd really you got to recognize it's part of an entire system. And so I had a conversation with this gentleman last week, and I said, look, you know, the prior administration was trying to kill this and wanted to shut it down, and it's going to hurt the rest of the state, and particularly this area of the state, if you do that. And I received assurances from him that he's going to keep it open.
Well, thank goodness. I remember working on that circa 2007 and 2008 with Howard Chandler, even though he was had moved up to PAC-AF. You know, the military installations are tight a little bit over there. We'd been working on the coal gasification, and that's when I found out so much about our not only just our Healy Clean Coal, but the grade of coal that we have that is perfect for this making.
It's unique. It's unique in the world, actually. It's
yes.
Very hard to find.
I thought, come on.
Coal. But, no, yeah. it turns out that we have extremely low sulfur in our coal and very low deleterious metals and other constituencies. It makes our coal very attractive and very clean burning.
So they're sending us to a break. I had the volume turned down so it didn't blare in our ears, but we'll be back with more Problem Corner. We're back on Problem Corner with our guest, Nick Begich III, our sole congressman representing all of Alaska. And I'm your guest host, Jennifer Uhas. Congressman, you wanted to lead in to this third segment talking about health care. A lot of people avoid it. You said you want to address it.
Yes. Yeah. Health care is so important. And, you know, particularly in Alaska, where we have some of the highest health care costs in the world, not just in the United States, in the world. And so it's something that's on a lot of people's minds, and I do want to talk about it because it's come up a few times in my trip this week. And I wanted to talk about Medicaid. Let's talk about Medicaid first, because this has gotten a lot of attention in the press, and as has SNAP. So as part of the American Families Tax Cuts, what was previously called the One Big Beautiful Bill, budget reconciliation, there were some adjustments made to these programs. So let's talk about SNAP first. So SNAP, no, first of all, no one is cut from SNAP. If someone is eligible for SNAP today, they're eligible for SNAP tomorrow.
No one was kicked off the rolls.
No one was kicked off the rolls. So for the SNAP program, there was an accountability measure that was introduced for states to make sure that they are getting it right. In the past, the government has paid 100% of SNAP, and states were simply a pass-through. And so in this revision, there's been a 5% match. So federal government still pays 95% of SNAP. States will now pay 5% of SNAP. But if a state is not administering their program properly, then there is a penalty. And in the past, there was not a penalty. And the state of Alaska had the highest, what they call improper payment rate of any state in the country. We were over 60%. That means over 60% of the payments that went out from our SNAP program were not correct. Well, that's not acceptable. And it's actually a problem because people who were reliant on that program also weren't able to get into the program. And so that backlog's being addressed. The number was 60%. I believe it's in the low 20s now, and it's been working its way down.
And we've that's got, work that needs to be done at the state level.
Same it's at the state
the
level.
Notice of pay problems and the other clerical
that's right.
errors.
That's right. It's at the state level, but we wanted to make sure we were incentivizing states to get it right. So that's the change on SNAP. On Medicaid, there were really three categories. There's waste, fraud, and abuse that happens in Medicaid, and we could go through a number of examples. I could probably pull some up on my phone real quick and show this doctor, this hospital, this group did something wrong with Medicaid, and they're being investigated, whatever. So that we want to tighten the controls to reduce the amount of activity that's waste, fraud, and abuse. Okay, that's category one. Category two is we have people in our nation that are not here legally that have been drawing on the Medicaid system. And it's not necessarily true in every state. It's not a major issue in Alaska, but it's a major issue in states like California. And it's drawing down resources in the system that are utilized for people who need it, Americans right. who need it. So that's bucket two. Bucket three is the one's probably gotten the most attention, and that's what they call the work requirement. So for able-bodied people. Now, to understand Medicaid, maybe you're on Medicaid or know someone who is, or maybe you don't know anything about the program, so let me just explain very briefly. There are two subpopulations. There's what they call traditional Medicaid. This is women and children. You know, it's very low income or low income families that are on Medicaid. Then there's and they are untouched with any of the revisions. We don't do anything to impact people's eligibility under that program. For the expanded Medicaid population, right?
Different category.
What we said was for people who can work, that are able-bodied, that are not currently working, we're going to add some requirements because they have the ability to contribute to the system. So what did we say? Well, we said we're going to have some exclusions. So if you're Alaska Native, if you're American Indian or Hawaiian Native, you're excluded because there's a government-to-government trust responsibility that the U.S. government has made with these populations to say we're going to take care of your health care.
There's another access.
That's right. Yeah, and so that is excluded. Then if someone is looking for a job but hasn't found one yet, they're not required. They don't have to have already had a job, right? So they're included in the Medicaid system still. If someone is a caregiver for a family member or a friend, they're excluded from the work requirement. If somebody is in a county or borough with more than 50% higher unemployment than the rest of the country, they're excluded too. So a lot of rural Alaska and different parts of Alaska are excluded because they have high unemployment rates out there. If somebody is, as I said, if they're looking for work, they're excluded. There's a number of these categories of exclusions that exist because we recognize that people making a good faith effort to contribute, that they shouldn't be penalized for that. In fact, there's an additional, and this is really important too, exclusionary category. If someone volunteers 20 hours a week, they're excluded from the work requirement.
Boy.
So if you really want health care and you can't find a job or don't, it doesn't fit your life situation, you can still volunteer.
There's so many ways to volunteer too.
Oh, and people need volunteers, right? Desperately. And but
programs that alleviate federal and state budgets need volunteers.
That's right. Well, yeah. And so, and here's the other thing too. These requirements don't kick in until 2028. So people have plenty of runway to sort out their personal situation. When we boil it all down, it's about 7% of the expanded Medicaid population, not that original component, but just 7% of the expanded Medicaid population this applies to. So I think that's all important. One additional thing on healthcare, you know, we hear a lot about MAHA. What's MAHA? Make America Healthy Again. You know, life is better when you don't have a medical problem.
I found that out last year after I was dumped off a four-wheeler.
Ooh, ouch. Ouch. Well, you know, and some problems are acute like that. Some become chronic, and sometimes those two things are related. And we want to make sure people have a healthier lifestyle because it's a lot. You live a better, higher quality life if you can avoid the problem in the first place. And so starting to make investments in healthier lifestyles, more information about how to have a healthier diet, taking things that are in our foods that are making us sick out. We need to do those things. And it hasn't been done. And so I think that's a really important priority. I know it is for this administration. It's important for me.
What do some of those look like? I know we're going into another break at the quarter here. And, you know, is that, you know, school lunch things? Is that pamphlets? I mean, what are we looking at?
I think it's all of the above, but it's also it's the FDA going in and looking at the ingredients that have been permitted to enter the food system.
Yeah, I saw one of the dyes just got axed.
That's right. So some of these dyes have been linked to cancer, mm-hmm. right? And look, a Skittle's going to taste the same, whether it's one shade of red or another. So, you know, I think that's important. And I think it's important to look, you know, internationally, there are food ingredients that are in our food supply that are not allowed in most other countries. And you got to ask yourself, okay, well, how did that happen?
And this is a universal issue. This isn't some hippie California liberal issue.
No.
This is people simply wanting healthy water, air, and food.
Yes, and that's a rational, reasonable thing for people to want. And the reality is when you look at some of the longitudinal data, meaning when you go back in time and you look at, you know, what has happened for, let's say, diabetes in youth or obesity and some of these other things, mm-hmm. something changed in the last 20 to 30 years that has made Americans net more unhealthy. And we need to go back to where we were before, get a healthier, some of it's technology, recognize that, but a lot of it is our food system and our food habits. And the federal government has a role in regulating what goes into the food supply.
And when we have the science to back it up, there's no
reason
not to follow that, whether it's mining, fishing, hunting, food additives, or what we're peddling out there and putting into our bodies that is or isn't food.
That's right. And if we want to address the long-term cost of healthcare, we need to reduce the number of health events that occur. That's key.
That is sage advice for our third segment here. We will be back with more Problem Corner after the break. And we're back on the air with Congressman Nick Begich, Congressman for All Alaska Now. I'm your guest host, Jennifer Juhas. And we just finished a segment on health care, and you wanted to wrap up with the ACA tax credits.
Yeah, so there's, you know, there's as part of what most people know as Obamacare or the Affordable Care Act, there are tax credits and certain subsidies that are provided depending on income level and a host of factors, family size, location in the country, et cetera. There were some enhancements, enhanced credits made to that program as a part of the COVID era response. So there were some changes made. Those are set to expire at the end of this year. And so that's certainly something that's being discussed down in Washington. What do we do about those credits? How are they extended? Are they extended? If they are, under what circumstances? But one of the things that we've learned over the last several years, when you talk about those categories of waste, fraud, and abuse, and it's a little bit wonky, but it's important to understand why there's a push to make some revisions to those. They found that at the lowest income category, where someone doesn't have to pay anything at all for health care, there's been a dramatic increase in the number of signups for those programs. And while the signups have increased dramatically, the utilization of the health care system among that cohort has been virtually zero. So that the incremental signups haven't really led to a proportional incremental increase in utilization. And so you look at that and you say, why would that be? Why would people be signing up for healthcare and they're never using it? And when you drill down one layer deeper, you find out, well, there's an incentive structure for brokers on the ground to sign people up because they get a kickback every time they sign up someone for healthcare. And so what we found is that there's hundreds of thousands, if not millions, of Americans who don't even realize that they have healthcare, and you're paying for it. And it's all
here. Do you want to sign this petition?
Here, exactly. That is some of what is going on. And these people, they don't know they have health care. They go in and they, you know, they may go to an urgent care clinic or an ER and still pay the full freight because they don't even know that they've been signed up.
So we're all being charged for their health care Netflix subscription.
Correct. Exactly. And, you know, we need to remove that fraud from the system. So that's a definite issue that needs to be addressed.
I know some other issues that you wanted to cover today were the university and support of our university system.
Yes, absolutely. You know, the university is a crucial part of Alaska. We were just talking about workforce development in an earlier segment and how important that is. The university plays an important part, not just in a traditional four-year setting, but also in two-year settings. You know, I was meeting with the new interim chancellor just yesterday, and we were talking about the nursing programs that they're rolling out. And something we were talking about during the break, it's so important for us to remember that as this new work hopefully comes to Alaska, it's going to stress existing services. So we need to make sure that we are investing in other more indirect but still supportive industries like the healthcare industry, right? Making sure that we can also grow our own homegrown workforce when it comes to things like nursing and other healthcare, health aid, and healthcare
practitioners. As someone who's a licensed dental hygienist for 17 years with anesthesia license, you know, I hear some of this compacting and, oh, well, we'll just honor someone else's license. There really needs to be a balance because mm-hmm. a dental hygienist trained in Virginia does not have the practice ability that I had under the Western Regional Examining Board. So there really would be you know, a healthcare risk to the public. But if there was a pathway to obtain those skills and then honor that in a shorter period of time, that's probably doable. I understand the complaints on each side, right? If I moved somewhere else, how could I practice? I'm more qualified than what you qualify for under your board. Why can't I practice here? At the same time, well, if you're moving somewhere else and our practice statute gives more mm-hmm. responsibility mm-hmm. that you haven't been trained in. We would need a pathway for that. So 4-year, 2-year PhD, or even just certifications.
That's right. Yeah. And the university does all of those things. And they do them, you know, in rural Alaska. They do it here in Fairbanks. They do it all over the state. And they're a really important part of our workforce development pipeline.
Now, this isn't just a puff piece for an hour, but you're a freshman legislator.
Yep.
You staffed for a while, but you didn't staff all areas of things. But we see you in the newspaper navigating your way through D.C., and you've used a couple of some of the things that people in the past or from other states may have been reluctant to use, such as the Congressional Review Act.
Yes. Yeah, so the Congressional Review Act is really unique. I mean, one of the in my first year here, what I've come to say is that the House is the gas and the Senate's the brake. We get a lot done in the House that there's a Senate process, and it's not. I'm not assigning anything to anyone. I'm just telling you that the process of the Senate is slower than the process of the House, and I think it's probably designed that way, and that's probably for good reasons. It can be frustrating for those of us in the House that are moving things through. But what we've also identified is that there are mechanisms around some of the slow nature of the Senate, and one of those is the Congressional Review Act.
Yeah, so we want to hear in our last segment how you've been doing that for us back there. That you've talked to staffers, you've talked to members of the public who have raised our fists.
Yes,
and you've used the Congressional Review Act. You've slid some things into.
Yeah, I'll explain. So So the Congressional Review Act, because it's unique, it allows us to bypass the 60-vote procedural threshold in the Senate. So we only need a majority in the House and a majority in the Senate. What does the Congressional Review Act say? It says that when the executive branch takes a series of executive actions that Congress does not agree with, Congress can send effectively a legal message over to the executive branch that says, you're not authorized to make those decisions again. We're going to repeal them, and we're going to ensure that if that ever occurs again from a future administration, you have to go back through Congress, which then requires that 60-vote threshold to enact these policies again. And so in Alaska, with the Biden administration, they came through and they were locking our state up. That's the reality. There were 70 executive orders and actions that were specific to Alaska, that targeted our ability to produce resources and create the jobs that we've been talking about today. And when they did that, myself, the senators, we said, hey, we've got to pull this back. And we just passed a Congressional Review Act action for the Central Yukon Resource Management Plan, repealed the restrictions on 13 million acres in Alaska that Biden had put down.
Let's talk about those restrictions.
Yeah.
The newspaper reported that it had been significant public process, and even though a lot of these things are noticed to the public, the counter to that has been that it was more driven by embedded employees, that just because they had said it for 15 years didn't make that something the public was invested in.
Right.
It was a vocal minority.
That's right.
And
yeah, most of the public doesn't participate in the public process. And so it's oftentimes the public process will not be reflective of the actual public sentiment. A lot of times as well, you're getting people from outside the region participating in the process because they're motivated by NGOs that have deep pockets, and they activate a national network of folks that are activists that are not Alaskan. And so,
in fact, some of what was repealed was enacted against the wishes of Alaskans who requested additional comment period. It requested reopening so that they could be heard.
That's right. And what this really was a backdoor way to lock up lands that are owned by the state of Alaska, right? And to start to sunset the Trans-Alaska pipeline. That's really what was going on. It was a way for them to say, we're not going to allow more pipeline activities. We're not going to allow mining activities. We're going to shut this down or shut down access to areas of the state that you could have those activities in.
Right when we're at the tipping point of possibly finally realizing our gas line.
Exactly. And so we had to remove those barriers. And anywhere we see those barriers, they will be removed. We had people in D.C. last week as a part of the House Natural Resources Committee subcommittee on oversight. And I sit on that subcommittee. And we brought in two panels for each of Alaskans, Republicans and Democrats. And you know what everybody said and everybody agreed to? That in Alaska, we are pro-development and we are pro-environment. No one is going to care about Alaska more than Alaskans will. And we do our projects right. And so for someone in Washington to come in and say, you're not going to be allowed to develop your resources because of some personal ideology and some bent that they have, no, we are going to pull that back.
And there's been a misconception nationally, and it perpetuated by some other groups with agendas, that those who utilize the outdoors and depend on the outdoors don't find development compatible. And many of the national organizations who represent outdoor users are starting to insert comments saying, you know, make sure that this management plan specifies that development, trapping, hunting are compatible uses with this land mass.
That's 100% true. And it's also compatible with the lifestyles that so many of us want to live. I mean, I was just, as I mentioned a couple of times, I was just out in Bethel, right? One of the things that we talked about in the community was we need private sector opportunities. We can't run parts of Alaska purely by government funding. Mm-hmm. You've got to have local activity. We talk about all this workforce development, and they have invested in that area of the state a great deal of energy on workforce development. Well, when the development of the workforce is done, work begins, and there has to be work, right? And that work is generally going to come from the private side. And so we've got to make sure all the state, where there are resources and they can be responsibly developed, that they are being developed. And we're not going to let Washington get in the way of our ability to develop our own futures here.
Well, before you go, you made some inroads to some of the things we've been working on for a very long time with our revenue on our resources.
Yes. Yeah. So we did, as a part of the budget reconciliation bill, get some really important things through for Alaska, something that we've been chasing for a long time. First of all, NPRA, okay, the 1002 area of AMWAR and Cook Inlet opened up nearly 30 million acres of new mandated, required oil and gas lease sales in those areas. That's more land than has ever been leased in the history of the state of Alaska in total. That's almost the size of the state of Florida as a part of this bill. But also as a part of that bill, I put in on the House side, I called the House Natural Resources Committee chair, and I said, we were made a promise that we would have an outsized share of federal revenues at statehood, and it has never been delivered. And I said, this is something we've talked about on the campaign. I heard about it from Alaskans. I hear about it from Alaskans.
Every day.
And I said, we need 90%. That's what we were promised. And we actually got 90% for these 30 million acres of federal revenues out of the House. Now, it went to the Senate, and it was adjusted, but we got 70. We split the difference.
It's not 50-50 anymore.
It's not 50-50. It's actually, when you look at the quantum of dollars, it's a 40% increase. From 50 to 20, that's 20 over 50, that's 40%. 40% increase in revenues from the federal government.
And I know you won't stop. You'll insert that into every new discussion that comes up.
I do all the time. I bring it up all the time. And it's a hard argument to make when I'm talking to other members, and it's probably why it took so long to make progress. And people have been, I mean, look, I respect the delegation that's been there for so long, but it's taken us 50 plus years to get to where we could get more than 50%. Frankly, I thought I was going to have to be in Congress for 20 years to get that done, and we did it in 6 months. And so now we get to work on some other things. But we'll keep working that 90-10. It's important that the government delivers on its promise, but I'm thrilled. And I, frankly, that may ultimately be the biggest thing I ever achieve in Congress, was bringing home more of our own money back to the state.
Well, thank you so much for seeking out Problem Corner, for taking your time to come in here. I know that you have a very packed 3 days visiting with constituents, and we're just glad that you took the time to come on with us.
Thank you. Great to be back.
That was our Problem Corner today. We had Congressman Nick Begich, MB3, visiting with us today on the first day of his 3-day tour in the interior. He's off to meet with another group of people assembled, and then after that, I think he's got meetings, he said, all the way through 8 p.m. But that was some valuable insight from our congressional delegation and everything that we're working on.